My pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Bill C. from Torrance.
Bill, alcoholic. God, I thought he was going to dump that cake all over. There should be a rule against fake cakes and electric candles and... Maybe not, huh? I get tired of hearing my story. You can usually tell when a speaker gets tired of hearing his story as he starts making stuff up. And really, when we do that, it's not really to build ourselves up. It's just to keep our own interest, you know? I think recovery is a lot more interesting. I've been sober since March of 1985. So I've been sober longer than I was drinking, which is pretty remarkable. And a lot more interesting stuff has happened to me in recovery than when I was out there. I'm the kind of drunk, when I drink, I don't show up no matter what. So, you know, stuff just doesn't happen. I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy, and I never went to the beach. You know, my motorcycle rarely ran, and I was afraid to fight. But I looked really good. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat and primary chain for a belt and black greasy Levi's and big black boots with chains around them. I've got tattoos all over me, but I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself. You know? I've been to so much therapy. I went to my first therapist when I was 13 because I had rage, not anger, but rage. I was in a mental institution twice. I spent 2.5 years in group therapy. I've been to several other psychiatrists and therapists over the years. You know, I've been gestalted and rolfed and primal screamed. I know more about myself than is safe to know. But it is my favorite subject, you know. I can just do me forever. And it was so bad that when I got sober at 37 years old, my mother came and got me. Yeah, that's what really good gangsters do. They call their mom in the end, you know. She came and got me, and she checked me into a place called Starting Point in Costa Mesa. While I was in there, they had me wear a sign around my neck. It was a little piece of cardboard, and we made it in crafts, you know, and it had a string that went through it, and it said, "I am not a counselor," because evidently there was some confusion about that, and that's my story. So at 37, I'm a newcomer in AA. What up? You know, it's like, what is this place? Why the hell are we here? How does it work? You know? I mean, you ever heard people get up at the podium and say they've been sober a long time? You know, the longer I'm sober, the less I know. Every time I hear somebody say that, I think, aren't you paying attention? I mean, you can sit around the rooms and not do a damn thing and kind of pick some shit up. You know, I mean, it's about living, isn't it? I think it's about living. And what do you and I know about living? Every one of us tells the same story. Every one of us tells the story about how long before we ever drank, we didn't feel part of, we didn't feel connected. We felt weird and strange and gawky and geeky, and the aliens had dropped us off and the mothership is returning to pick us up. And we all have a different way of telling that, but we all tell the same story. We say things like, I had the ism long before I ever drank. And we all nod like we understand what that is. A lot of us, when we tell that story, we use this term alcoholic thinking. As if there is such a thing. I mean, you repeat something often enough, everybody just kind of nods their head and goes, oh, yeah, I got alcoholic thinking. That's what my problem is, you know. You know, the only place you ever hear that phrase, alcoholic thinking, is in Alcoholics Anonymous. No one else ever uses that phrase. Matter of fact, Silkworth heard it. He wrote a paper about it in 1940. You can imagine him in the early AA meetings. he hears that phrase and he thinks to himself, oh God, they're making stuff up now. You know, it didn't take very long before we started making up our own stuff. You know what the professional community says about us? They say that we are emotionally immature. And we hear that and we go, no! I have special thinking. I have alcoholic thinking, and it's never going away. And you need to consider that when you're dealing with me. I have special thinking. I think we're emotionally immature. I'm pretty convinced of it. I think what happened to you and I is when we started drinking, we stopped growing emotionally. Every kid feels separate from it. If anybody here has had the experience of raising teenagers, they're aliens, you know? And you can see that look in their eye when they're 9 or 10 or 11 and you're their favorite toy, and then somewhere around 11, 12, 13, they're looking at you and you know what they're thinking, that you are the stupidest creature they've ever met in their entire life, you know? And you have all the power. We have the power, and they don't like that, and they push the envelope. The difference between us and the other kids is that we medicated that feeling and we never grew out of it. And when I got here at 37 years old, I had the emotional development of a 16-year-old. And this kid was not an honor student. He was not mature beyond his years. This was the kid that had a bit of a problem with authority. You know, the one at 17 years old that had the big jacket and the slouch and the foul mouth and a bad attitude and a gun in his back pocket, and he'd already been to jail. He was starting his career path. It's, you know, there he was. That's who came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I look like I'm growing up. I'm big and stuff, you know. But I have no connection to other people. At that time in my life, at 37, I was married for the second time, and I had my second pair of children. And these kids were very young. The little boy was less than a year old. Little girl was coming up on 3. And I lived in the house with that wife and those two kids, and I had no emotional connection to another living human being. And I didn't know that. I can't stand outside myself and have a separate experience and compare it to the one that I'm having to determine that there might be something wrong. How would I know that I'm disconnected if I've never been connected? I can't tell the difference. The thief thinks everyone else is a thief. The alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. You know why it seems like the only normal one to us? Because it's the only one we've ever had. What would normal feel like? If you've never been normal, how would you know to look for normal? How would you know that the way you're living is abnormal? But somehow we're able to justify peeing on our friends and stuff. It's pretty interesting how we make that transition. Oh, it's okay, you know. So at 37, I walk into Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no social skills, or very few. I don't know anything about intimacy. I don't know how to connect to people. Most of us talk about, we all tell the story about how we felt odd and weird, and then we have a couple of drinks and it all goes away. And we find the elixir, we find the solution. And I think the whole idea behind the drinking thing was to get out of the house and go to the party and have an adventure and have some fun. I ended up naked in my living room watching religious television, taking notes. Party, you know. I mean, I'm having sex, menage a uno. There's no one else in the room, you know. I mean, next time some guy walks in here and says, well, I'm just a party kind of guy, ask him, how many other people were at the party? You know, we have a strange ability to end up physically completely alone. And we'll fight for our right to party, huh? So we walk into AA. These are the skills that we walk into AA with, you know. And you hear lots of stuff. You hear people say, get a sponsor, work the steps. And then you hear other people say, well, no, just don't drink and go to meetings, you know. The fellowship seems interesting initially to some people. I was lucky. I liked AA fairly quickly. Within the first couple of weeks, I just liked it. You tripped me out. You know, I heard a guy say not long ago that he stayed sober for the first 6 months just on the stories. Just the stories, just alone, just coming to the meetings, listening to the stories, and relaxing into his seat. You hear people around AA say that we've lost our edge, that we used to be a lot more effective than we used to be, that we've lost something, maybe. But when you're new, you just walk in and you go, what now? What do I do now? I got lucky. After a couple of weeks, I asked this guy to sponsor me, and he said, come to my house Thursday at 5 o'clock, read the doctor's opinion. Make notes in the margin of what you agree with and what you don't, and we'll discuss it. So I did that. I went and I did my homework. And I showed up at his house at 5 o'clock on Thursday, and he did not trust me that I'd read it to him, and he had me sit in his living room and read it to him out loud. Rule number one when you're sponsoring people, make sure they read the book. I mean, there's lots of people that say, well, I don't know, what would I say? What would I do? What, you know, I don't know how to give anybody any advice. I don't know anything. You don't have to say anything. You just listen to them for 10 or 15 minutes because they got to talk about what's going on. You're going to identify with about 95% of it. It's the same insanity that you came from. All the things that he thinks his problems are, her, them, it, the job, money, no money. And then you read the book together. You read a page and he reads a page. You read a page and he reads a page. And any conversation that needs to come out of that will come up. Any conversation that needs to happen. My job as your sponsor is to guide you through the process of the 12 steps that you might find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problems. I mean, stop and think about this. I've been married 3 times. People ask me for relationship advice. I give it to them. I figure, hell, you can't hurt them. They're in AA. You know, it's like, plus, whatever advice I give them could not possibly be worse than what they're planning on doing anyway. You know, really think about it. Yeah. It's like when I got out, after 35 days in my hospital program, they let me out. They just let us out like we're okay, you know. Go forth, multiply, you know. And I end up, where do you end up? When they let us out, where do we end up? Here. This is the world's aftercare program. There's no other place to go. When all the insurance money runs out, when they're all done gestalting and rolfing, when they're all done with us, we end up in the world's aftercare program. It's linoleum floors and metal folding chairs for the rest of our natural lives. Do you know that there's no referrals from AA? There's no place you go where you walk in and you say, I'm from AA. They sent me here. That place doesn't exist. This is it, man. The inmates are running the asylum. This is us. We are the counselors. We are the counselors. And you hear people say from the podium, people will say, we don't express opinions or give advice. If we didn't do those two things, we wouldn't have a damn thing to say to each other. Of course we give advice. Of course we express opinions. You know, of course we do. Hopefully it's based upon our experience. But how do you learn not to give so much advice? By giving it and having nobody ever take it. That's when you finally give up. You know? Like you're always telling, don't go out with her. You quit doing that because he's gonna go out with her. He can't help himself, you know? You can't run people's lives. People say AA is a cult. There's one interesting aspect to this cult. You can leave whenever you want. You know, it's hard to maintain the cultishness of something if you can just leave whenever you want. But I shaved my head. I'm part of the cult. I got the secret underwear and the special handshake and everything, you know? I bought the whole package. And there is kind of an insular feeling. There's, you know, people that really get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous feel part of something that's much deeper than where they've come from before. I think those people feel a lot more part of something than most of the people in AA, too. So I showed up at this man's house every Thursday at 5 o'clock, and we read a chapter in the book, and we worked the steps the way they came out of the book. You know, people say, well, work them exactly how they come out of the book. Well, there's interpretations of that, isn't there? I mean, my approach to it has changed over the years. What I think to be really significant compared to what I thought about it 10 or 15 years ago. So here's what I think now, for whatever it's worth. Take it for whatever it's worth. The first step says that we're powerless. They took it easy on us. They just told us that we were powerless over alcohol because they didn't want us to run screaming down the street. After 26 years of relatively deep research, I've yet to find anything that I have any power over at all. I think I am utterly and completely, totally powerless over anything in my life, over anything at all. I'm not of the school that believes that now that I'm sober, I've been re-empowered and been given back the power of choice. I understand that there's a school within AA that believes that. It's just not my experience. I don't believe that's true. I think I'm utterly powerless. When I look out in nature, I don't see anything else that has any power either. I think the totality of all things requires no input from me whatsoever for the unfolding to occur. I think it just happens. And what happens to me is I judge these things that occur. Something will happen in my life and I will judge it as bad or as good, either way. I look out in nature, there's no morality in nature. There's no good or bad. I think things just are. I think all of the suffering in my life comes from me judging the good and bad of what I see happen around me. I look at things and I say they're unjust or unfair or not right. And no matter what my opinion is, they remain the same. It does not change. And I suffer over my judgment of that, whatever that might be. And I suffer from that. All my suffering comes from that. The lion eats the lamb every single time. And we look at that and we don't like it. We say that the lion shouldn't eat the lamb. Look at the poor innocent lamb, and the lion just chews him up and he's blatting and bleating. There's blood splattering everywhere. And we go, that ain't right. But it continues to happen. So we make up parables that say there will be a time that will come sometime in the future where the lion will lay down with the lamb. If that ever occurs, I'll bet you that lamb will be nervous for eternity. Because it is the nature of the lion to eat the lamb, and there is no morality in it. It's not a good or bad thing. I believe that's how my life is. My life is unmanageable because it does not require any management. It just unfolds. If I'm in this centered place, and if I'm in the present moment, if I'm just allowing whatever is to happen, the next indicated thing for me to do becomes incredibly obvious. Very apparent. It's all the clouding that I put around that and the layering that I put over it that causes me confusion. If I lose somebody that's close to me in my life, I hurt, I feel pain of that loss. There's nothing wrong with that. It's part of life. I think pain is part of life. It has a life of itself. As we live on the remoteness of that, it doesn't affect us on a day-to-day basis, but we can certainly remember back and remember mom and dad and feel that little twinge. A lot of times there's a sweetness to the pain, actually, because the memory still lives, the person still lives within us. When I look at that death or whatever kind of loss it might be and I say that should not have happened, that was unfair, it was unjust, it wasn't right, now I've laid suffering over the top of the natural pain, and the suffering is all on me. It's all on me. So I'm utterly powerless. It only takes about 20 years to get that. You know, about 20 years it starts to come home. My sponsor said to me, "You will be reduced to prayer and meditation." That has happened to me. And it took about 20 years for that really to come home. If I, as a newcomer in AA, if I can grasp the powerlessness just a little bit, if I can just get a little bit, just the drugs and the alcohol part, it makes the second step operational. I need a manager. I need to be restored to sanity. Certainly enough sanity not to drink and use, but also enough sanity to be able to see the powerlessness, just glimpse it a bit, to really to let go and begin, just begin the process of acceptance. So the second step becomes operational. It doesn't matter what I believe in about it or anything. If I can do that a little bit, if I can just cop to it just a little bit and say, okay, I'm willing to look at the manager situation here, the third step becomes operational. Now, the third step's kind of interesting. I think it's a throwaway. They wanted to give us something so that we actually feel like we're participating in this process, that we have some control over it. So they're asking us to make a decision, just a decision, to turn our life and will over to what already has it anyway, as if we have really some say in the matter. You know, it's our own delusion, really, that tells us that we have some control. But the third step, at least we're a player in the process. So what life and will is it talking about in the third step? The fourth step. The resentments, fears, and broken relationships. Resentments because evidently my happiness is dependent upon your behavior. Because I spent an inordinate amount of time trying to adjust you so that we can both be happier. You know, if you would just see it my way. It's like the story in the book about the actor in the play. I used to think the actor wanted to be the director. No, the actor doesn't want to be the director, because if he's the director, he can't be the star of the play. The actor wants to be all of it. He wants to be all of it. He wants to run the entire show, all the time. And even though his intentions might be good, isn't he a creator of confusion? Isn't that us? I think I have all the best intentions in the world. If you would just see it my way and adapt to my approach, then things would be a lot better. You're just deluded and you can't see it very well. I'm trying to help you. Guaranteed suffering. Guaranteed suffering. If my happiness is dependent upon your behavior, guaranteed suffering. Nothing will ever change. So I have resentment. And this is just not your average pissed offness. This is a core kind of a thing. You ever hated somebody really good, then on a certain day you forget to hate them, so the day after that you got to hate them extra to make up for the day you skipped? I mean, a really good resentment, really good hatred, really in-depth. Something that runs your life, that when you wake up in the morning, it starts grinding and it grinds throughout the day. And then at the end of the day, you keep grinding on it as you go to sleep. That kind of resentment, that's what rules my life. Fear, you bet I got fear, because this is not working and I have no plan B. So I'm afraid of everything. And I hate you and I'm afraid of you at the same time. I can't stand being around you, but I can't live without you. I can't ever be alone, ever. Being alone is worse than suffering through life with you. You know, so I picked the suffering with you. And what a wonderful relationship we have. That's why the last one is, you know, the sexual inventory, sex relations, relations with intimate people. You know, if what I'm bringing to the table is resentment and fear, what could these relationships be other than dramatic and traumatic? Of course they all are. They all were. They were all traumatic and all dramatic, and it was just horrible. So we do that inventory. The fifth step is the ceremony that we go through to complete the third step. We tell ourselves and another human being and the manager, here's my stuff, I'm pooped, you take it. Maybe for the first time in our lives, we begin to take responsibility for our behavior. Just the beginning. This is just the beginning of finally coming to understand that it isn't them, it's never them. Even though it looks like them, it smells like them, it's not them, it's us. 6 and 7 are two paragraphs in the book. There's nothing to do, and we'll be doing that nothing for the rest of our lives. You can see what the defects of character are. They're in the fourth column of the resentment list. It does not say what was my part. It says, what were my faults and mistakes? So even if you came from a place of child abuse or sexual abuse, what part is there in that? Truly, you were a victim, an innocent victim. If you're 40 years old and you're still carrying that resentment around, at the very minimum, you're unforgiving. And those perpetrators don't feel the anger and the pain that you feel. It's you that feels it. And this is about you freeing yourself from that to move on with your life. So it's not my part, is what are my faults and mistakes? Sometimes there's a part, many times there's not, but there's usually always a fault and a mistake somewhere along the line if I'm still carrying this bag around with me, because this thing is about freedom. It's about being free of all that and moving on. After 6 and 7, the manager gives us our first assignment. He says, we're going to go make amends, make a list. Put all the resentment people on there and anybody that you owe money to or anything you owe anybody, put it on the list. We're going to go about the process of making amends. The mechanism for ridding ourselves of these resentments is the amends process. If we can go back to these people and look them in the eye and clean up our side of the street, we become free. You'll hear people say, you've been your own worst enemy, put yourself at the top of the amends list. That'll pretty much kill you. That's almost as deadly as you've got to learn to love yourself before you can love others, which is almost as deadly as take what you can use and leave the rest. That'll kill you dead, you know. You're going to allow me to pick and choose what I will and won't do with this finely tuned instrument that I've brought to you? You know, when have I ever consciously put myself in a position to be uncomfortable? Ever in my life. I lived my entire life that way, taking what was easy, taking what was simple, taking what belonged to you. And whatever made me uncomfortable or I didn't want, I just left it. I've always loved myself, but you were self-destructive. Yes, but I didn't know that. I was just trying to make myself feel good all the time. That was my primary motivation, is to feel good all the time. If you let me love Billy, I'll never get around to you. You know, I'll get lost in my billness, you know, and never get around to you. There's no space for you in there. You know, there's no space. So at the end of the 9th step, am I capable of intimacy and healthy relationships? Have I been freed? Am I cool now? No. We're not even close yet. 1 through 9 is about 15% of the program. It's sober 101. It's the bare minimum. And God, we suffer over it, don't we? We have 15-column expanded versions of the inventory. We've got manuals and workshops and year-long seminars and a new awakening and a new experience with the steps and just this constant thing that you hear, inventory after inventory. It's just another form of self-obsession. If you're sitting out there tonight and you got 3 or 4 years sober and you're working on your 3rd or 4th inventory, throw it away. You've missed the point. It's not about you. It's not about me. It's not about me finding more out about me. You know, it isn't it. If I spend all my time in my past digging up to find the root cause of my problems, I'm going to completely miss what I'm unfolding into today that has no connection to my past whatsoever. This is a brand new life. Brand new life. 10, 11, and 12, people say, are the maintenance steps. Maintain what? What have I got now at the end of the 9th step that needs maintenance? You know, is this thing just about not drinking? I don't think so. There's a lot of people that do, though. It's just not been my experience. You know, for 26 years, the issues in my life have not been about drinking and using. Hardly ever at all. It's all about getting along with you. You know. I mean, when I tried to control and enjoy my drinking, my way of controlling is first thing you got to do is you got to quit shooting heroin because you can't get anybody to go along with the concept of social heroin use. It's pretty much a lifestyle, you know. And you got to quit taking LSD because normal people have two-way communication with each other. And LSD is a pretty much a one-sided kind of thing. You don't really need another person there to have a conversation, you know. And so what I did is I just drank on the weekends because normal people had jobs, and every time I drink, I couldn't show up. And I watched normal people, and they go to work like days in a row. Did you know that? I've watched them do it. It's incredible. So what I did during the week is I smoked pot because it's green and it's from God and it's not really drugs, you know. And this was the Bill Cleveland maintenance program. This was my maintenance program. Because I don't know about you, but the impact of your personality on me is devastating. I cannot do you. I need something in my system all the time to cushion the blow of you on me. I just can't walk around with naked blood and just do you. You know, I flip out. I can't do it. So what's changed? When I quit doing all that stuff and I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, did all that stuff go away? No, man. I'm a raw nerve now. I'm walking into a room and somebody's looking at me and I go, what the hell are you looking at? And then if you don't look at me, I'm heartbroken. You know? My sponsor used to say, oh, did I hurt your feeling? Because there's only one. There's not like there's a myriad of emotional stuff going on here. You know, I mean, it isn't there. The problem I have today is not the character defects that are so glaring and obvious that even I can notice them. It's the parts of me that are completely missing. There's stuff I never picked up. I don't know compassion. I never learned compassion. And the offshoots of compassion are patience and tolerance. If you have compassion, you have patience and tolerance. And I don't have compassion. I can't feel you in my life. I can't, and I don't know it. You ever had anybody say to you, he's not emotionally available for me? You ever heard that? Usually in family group, you know. When she finally looks at you and looks at the therapist and goes, he's just not emotionally available for me. And we listen to that and we go, what the hell is she talking about? I mean, you think that I'm hiding something. Matter of fact, when they say that, you know what they mean by that? What they mean when they say that I'm not emotionally available for them is I've got something that they want and I'm withholding it. The truth is worse. I don't have it. And I don't know that I don't have it. You've convinced me that I've got it, and I'm helping you look for it. And this dance is going to go on forever. Now that I'm a newcomer in AA, if you would like me to be emotionally available for you, it's going to take about at least 10 years. At least that long. Because what's going to have to happen to me, there's no intellectual insight of my emotional nature that's going to come to me where the light's going to come on and my behavior will change. That does not happen. What happens is I have a series of experiences that cause me to change as I go through each experience. And I look back on it and I go, whew, that was painful. Next time I'm turning left, you know, because turning right is not the way to go. That's how we learn. That's how our children grow up and learn. They make mistakes and they learn from the mistakes. And that's how you and I are going to grow up in this fellowship. Is we're going to make mistakes. Every one of us is going to have the opportunity to wear the clown suit. You know, with the big nose and the feet and the whole thing. You know, I'm middle-aged. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm almost 40 years old. The chances of me growing up in AA and looking good are really slim. That's just not going to happen. So what 10, 11, and 12 are, it's where we live. It's where we live. We work 1 through 9 so that we have some kind of a message that has depth and weight so that we're capable of actually doing the action around here that will cause us to grow up. 1 through 9 is not going to cause us to grow up. We're just getting prepared to begin the process. So right up front, you can tell if you don't do that stuff, nothing changes. And I mean nothing. Nothing changes. The depth of my relationships don't change. Nothing happens. Nothing changes. I might stay sober, and I'll be 10 years sober, and she'll be standing in front of me saying, "You're not emotionally available for me." And I'll be screaming in her face, "What the hell do you want from me? I go to work. I'm bringing home a paycheck. And it looks like I'm just stupid because I don't get it. But the truth is, I really don't understand what you're trying to say to me. I've never been connected to another human being. I don't know what that feels like." And what intimacy is to me is when I can feel what you feel. I'm not just reacting to how you feel impacts me. Because that's how I live my life. I just react to how you impact me. Oh, God, she's all pissy now. It's going to be a hell of a weekend. I got to do something. Maybe I'll get her flowers or some shit like that, you know. You know, it's that bad. And you're the one I care about. It's that bad. The depth of my shallowness knows no bounds. I am going to continue to be an unfulfilling inhabitant in your house forever. It's going to be like that. And you'll finally leave. If you have self-worth, you'll finally get the hell out. You know. So 10, 11, and 12 is where we live. 10 is the continuing inventory process. There's a difference between self-obsession and self-awareness. And in 10, I can watch myself move through life. I can be the observer, the witness of watching myself move through life. I can evaluate my day. I can catch myself in mid-insult. I get the count of 10, maybe. You know, I can clean up my mess right away. I can have an interactive relationship with the sponsor. And maybe by this time, if I've been around a few years, I've got other people that are doing the same work that I'm doing, and we can talk in a real way about what's going on. As these emotions begin to swell up in me, as I have these experiences, as I begin to fall in love with you. The mechanism for teaching me intimacy is the men in Alcoholics Anonymous. The men have taught me the intimacy, not the women. The women are the program of attraction. But the men, by sponsoring them, by trying to help them, by getting involved in their lives, my life began to change. I started having a real live spiritual experience and awakening by interacting with the men on this intimate level, alone in a room reading the book with them, not telling them stuff like, "Sure, I'll sponsor you, read the book. If you run into a problem, give me a call." I'm not sure what that is, but it's not the experience I had. This guy let me in his home. He gave me his time. He spent time with me. He said things to me like, "Bill, your opinion is absolutely irrelevant. We don't need you here. You need us." He said, "I'd be happy to talk to you about what you think your problems are so that you will not share about them in the meetings." Yeah. "The meetings are for recovery from alcoholism, not about how your day went." You know, I said, "You know, they're breaking that rule down at the Alano Club right and left. Should we go tell them?" You know. You know, he had the courage to tell me his AA, the way he saw AA. He wasn't afraid to express his opinion to me. He didn't buy that crap that, "Well, we just stay neutral," you know. He told me how he felt about AA. And what I see today, the meetings where people come in there day after day and share about how their life went, these are people that don't have sponsors. And it's okay. AA is a safe place. There's many, many doorways and entryways into Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe what some people need is to come down and just hear about people being honest about what's going on in their life. There's nothing negative about that. But my opinion is, if you want to grow up, if you really want to grow beyond it, if you want to go beyond that, you'll do something else. The 11th step is about prayer and meditation. It says meditation, my sponsor loves to say, meditation is not extra credit. It's part of the step. You got to do it. In meditation, you can have a remarkable experience. In meditation, you can watch your thoughts. You can sit quietly, be comfortable, breathe in and out, Focus on the breath moving in and out of your nose. And when your mind wanders, gently bring it back to the breath. So you're catching your head thinking, aren't you? So who's doing the catching? Well, one thing's for sure. I am not my thinking mind. That is not who I am. That is a game-changing experience. That changes everything. Everything. I don't have to change it. I don't have to analyze it. I don't have to do battle with it. I can just ignore it. We even in AA here, we say, my head's out to get me. We talk about it in the third person. I think we kind of got it. Of course, we make it negative and adversarial. That's us, you know. It's a bad neighborhood. Don't go in there alone, you know, stuff like that. But I don't think my head's out to get me. I think it's trying to help. It's just stupid. I mean, stop and think about it. Why would it kill the host? Really? Why would it kill the host? I think it truly is trying to help. But it's very flat. It's two-dimensional. It's not creative. It doesn't come up with anything new, ever. All it does is take the past and project it into the future. You know, they were looking for you then. They're looking for you now. They're going to be looking for you tomorrow, you know. I mean, you can say, I had an experience. I walked outside and I stubbed my toe, and it hurt. I ended up on the ground holding my toe, whimpering, which is pathetic, but it hurts. And then it starts. That wouldn't have happened if you weren't so old, fat, and clumsy. You always wanted to play football, but you didn't like the contact. You were a major disappointment to your father. And I go, I just stubbed my toe! What is all this other stuff? What is this stuff when it comes up with this? What is this self-talk? What is this crap that it comes up with that tells me that I'm stupid and I'm fat and I'm old and I'm bald and I'm dumb and, you know, what is all that? Where does it come from? Who cares? Who cares where it comes from? But there's a whole industry out there that wants me to live in that. It wants me to live there and write about it and analyze it. And dig holes to look for deeper meaning and sources and stuff as if I had any depth to dig from, you know? Sandy Beach says, you know, there's what happened and then there's my story and then there's what really happened. I don't know anymore what really happened back. Who cares? What's going on right now is that now that I can watch those thoughts, I don't have to buy into it. I can bring it back to the breath. I can bring it back to feeling the chair hold me up. I can bring it back to the present moment where it does not want to be because there is nothing for it to do in the present moment. Because in the present moment, everything is absolutely as it should be all the time. How could it possibly be any different than it is? That's all you and I have right now is the present moment. There is no future. There is no past. They don't exist. There's only right here, right now, in this moment. Well, if you live like that, then how can you plan for the future? You can plan, just don't pack. Because you have no idea what's going to happen. You know, you have no idea. The 12th step is why we're here. Should everybody sponsor? There's nothing else to do. There is no other job in Alcoholics Anonymous. There is nothing, literally nothing else to do. Everything else is an activity. And I've done all the activities. I've been the CSR and a GSR and the board of the central office, the board of the Milano Club, on the roundup committee. And I love the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I mean, we cook the chili every year at the Labor Day for the Labor Day picnic challenge over at my house. And we make such good chili that everything is rigged so that we can't win. And we just let them know that we're on to them and stuff, you know. But we're not going away. We keep cooking the goddamn chili, and everybody knows that we're the best, you know. I manipulate and control my home group from behind the scenes. I think they're all on to me now, you know. But I love the fellowship. I love being around alcoholics. I enjoy you immensely. But don't ever mistake the activity for the action. Don't ever mistake it for that. And thousands of people do. People say, well, I don't sponsor people, I do other things. Like what? What other things could you do that would bring to you what I've described about how to have truly intimate relationships? What other activity could you do that will open your heart to the extent that this work will open your heart to? What opinions do you have that will be addressed by other things other than this? Like, I used to stand up here and say that if you were on medication, you weren't sober. You know why I said that? Because I heard some of you say that. It seemed like a real right-wing, badass opinion to have. And I don't require any facts to form an opinion. I can just do it on the fly. It's a talent that I have, you know? So some of you guys, you people give me a forum to stand up here and say stuff. So I started saying this stuff. And if you open your heart to this work, if you truly open your heart to this work, whatever prejudice you have will walk across the room and ask you for help. And now you have a choice to make. If you want to hang on to the prejudice, tell it no. Send it away. And you can find support for that here. Whenever I hear somebody now say, I don't work with people on medication, I move away from them so when the lightning comes down, I will not be collateral damage. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nowhere else to go. And when anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to be there. For that, I am responsible. My opinions don't matter a thing, a bit, at all. Somebody's asked me for help. How could I possibly say no? How is it possible to say no? Are you actually going to put me in the position to determine whether people are correctly alcoholic enough for me to work with? Do you think I'm qualified to make that decision? I don't. I mean, I'm arrogant as hell. You can probably tell that. But I have limitations on that. So I said yes to this guy. He says, I'm bipolar. I'm on medication. I had the experience of peeling him off the ceiling and lifting him up off the floor. He's a 40-year-old grown man. He came across my living room one time, curled up in my lap, put his head in my neck, and cried like a baby, and I just rocked him. My wife walked through the living room. She goes, whoa. I mean, that'll get your attention. People have demons that I don't have. And evidently, if I don't have them and you have them, I think you're faking or something, or it's not real, because it's not my experience, therefore it doesn't exist. Evidently, because that's the way I behave. Now when I see that guy come and I say, have you taken your medication? So I had an opinion. Then I had an experience, and it changed my opinion. That's how it works. And if you shelter yourself from the experience, the opinions never change. If the opinions never change, you never change. We just don't change. I had a guy walk up to me one time and say, will you sponsor me? I think I should tell you that I'm gay. And I said, well, wouldn't you rather have a gay sponsor? He looked right at me. I'll never forget this. And he said, no, he says, I don't have a problem being gay, but drinking is an issue. Who knew? You know? Who knew? Who knew? I've been with you when you died. I've been with you when your children have been born. You've been with me when I've been in the hospital. You spent the night with me when I was in the hospital. The nurses thought John and I were gay. And I thought, well, at least he's younger and good looking. You know? Yeah. You have taught me to be intimate. I have a marriage today, a relationship with a woman that I never thought was possible. She's 21 years sober. She sponsors a lot of girls. I sponsor a lot of guys, and we try to keep them separated, but we feed them all. You know, the young people are coming in now. There's another big prejudice. All the kids are coming in, and all the old guys are starting their own meetings where they can only be around with each other where they do AA correctly.
Because we're not a daycare center.
You know, can you imagine that? What a wonderful attitude. Don't you just want to be an old piece of shit, angry bastard, you know, in AA? Didn't that just warm your heart, you know? It's like, God, whatever you do, don't do anything new, you know? We had a kid in our home group one night. He was 15 years old, taking a cake for 1 year sober. And he's a little sure he hadn't done growing yet, you know, so he's only 3 feet tall. He's standing at the head of the room. This is the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag. We're the epicenter of sobriety. We're sober correctly there. We're all opinionated, you know? And so it's an intimidating meeting, it can be, you know? So this kid standing up there, he gave the most right-wing death squad AA pitch I've ever heard in my life. He starts yelling at the end, he's pointing his finger, and he says, if you're sitting out there and you don't have a sponsor and you're not working the steps, may God have mercy on your soul. I went up to him after the meeting and asked him to be my sponsor. Kind of scared me, you know? And that room on a Monday night has over 100 guys in it, and I'll bet you half that room now, within the last 8 or 9 years, half that room is under the age of 24 years old. And a lot of those guys are 6, 7, 8 years sober. And they're sponsoring all the punks. And, you know, we make them leave their skateboards out and, you know. I love the kids. This is what Bill Wilson wanted. Recovery is accessible to all levels of our society now. And we run the show. It's us. We're here. We need to welcome them. We need to welcome them with open arms. It'll change our lives because we know it'll change their lives. You'll hear people around here say you got to give it away to keep it. No. You got to give it away to even get it. If you're not giving it away, you don't have it. Thank you.